Hey everybody, welcome back to another Monday, best night of the week. You know what that means? It's time for another episode of RFRX, your prescription for coping. I'm Kara, I'll be your host this evening, and I have my trusty co-pilot with me here, Helen. Helen, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Like I said in the pre-show, I'm exhausted because I was trying to put couch covers on my couch, which should have only taken me maybe 20 minutes. I worked on it for an hour and a half and fighting stuff, and I'm hot and tired and annoyed. And it's still not done.
I was gonna say you do have a nice glow
I am
to you,
sweaty.
so
I'm
you know,
sweaty. Sweaty.
there's that. At least you got some activity. Yeah,
I
home
did. Yeah.
furnishings
So,
are
and
the
I am trying
worst.
to lose weight. So I'm going to count that I worked out.
Hey, that counts as a
There's
workout.
always
Like if,
loopholes.
yes, every once in a while my Fitbit tells me that I've been exercising and I'm like, wow, I must be really out of shape that that happened while I was, sitting down. But whatever works. Well, I'm glad you made it and that you got some exercise anyway. Good luck with that. With the couch cushions, I mean.
Well,
You don't
I'm
need
the
any
next
more.
step is to get husband involved and have him help me because he has more upper body strength than I do. And really, that's why we have been around our houses because they can do stuff like that.
That is one good reason. Yes.
Kara, do you want to introduce Nick? Nick, yes, you do. I know you do.
Yes, I
Because I didn't
do.
highlight
Yes, so
it.
that means I would love to. Yes, I am super excited to introduce our guest tonight. Nicholas Lamar Suter graduated from Clark University with bachelor's degrees in philosophy and psychology. He has authored several essays and books on politics and social science, as well as science fiction, which I'm super pumped about talking about later, including some of his books are The Water Thief and Confessions of a Sin Eater. And he used to run the Humanist Codex and now hosts a secular news and education channel on YouTube called In Time. So we'll hear a little bit more about that later. But Nick, welcome to the show. And by the way, I want to say I love your suit. I hear that might be a $400 suit.
Oh, dear Lord, that's what I get for telling people. This is what happens when you can't keep your mouth shut. The $400, the famous $400 suit, recently auctioned at the Tang conference for a quarter. I'm still a little ticked off about that, but okay. There's
But did
I
it?
can't I can't to date I still can't do a show without it. So I'm serious when I'm wearing the
I
$400
feel I appreciate you being dressy.
Oh, well, thank you.
You're very professional. We appreciate
that. And we
There's a huge
also.
long story behind it, but it's yeah, it's th this has been famous now on our show for 3 years, and one of these days I'll find a way to. I try to stream without it, and I'm like, something's wrong, man. I said my skin
Now
starts to
I feel
crawl, so that's it.
naked.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, and it fits well with your background. It is very distinguished looking there with your books and shelves and everything. So it works. It works.
You had
So.
mentioned the water thief in it. There's a man at the end who's wearing a suit, and the suit is very, actually it's important to the character and yada yada yada. But there was a review on the water thief that said, the book was good. I liked the book, but really what I liked most was the description of that suit. That's how you wear a suit. And I was just like, okay, I'm now known for not known for philosophy or anything like that, but I can tell you how to wear a suit.
Well, now I need to read this book. I'm kind of excited. I was already excited to read it, and I was sad that I didn't get a chance to check it out before this week, but I am reading it after we get done talking, and now I know I am going to further learn how to wear a suit properly. So I'm pretty excited. We learned how to tie our shoes correctly a few weeks ago from a physicist, so we're about to be set. Yes.
We
Apparently
learned all
many of
types of
us,
things on these talks.
yes. Yeah. We learned all sorts of things wrong in our early years, and we try to get that sorted out around here. So we're happy for any of the advice you can give us. Do you have, before we move on, one piece of advice that people can take away for how to better wear a suit if they have one?
Wear it as often as you can. An argument I've actually made before is that wearing a suit is part of a language.
Oh.
You and we actually have hidden languages that we, all the time, both in what we wear, how we do. When I go to get my car repaired, when I see the mechanic coming out of the shop, I go up and the first thing I do is I go and shake his hand. The reason is because he's going to try to shake mine. And the reason he's going to try to shake mine is he's got grease on his hands and he wants to see if I'm the kind of guy who's going to be bothered by that. So rather than wait for him to do that little test, which is its own method of communication, I just go up, extend my hand because I know I'm going to have to anyway. So he's like, okay, this is a guy who's not afraid to get a little dirty. The way you wear a suit, it's very easy to see who's comfortable in one and who's not. It's very easy to see, you know, who knows how to maneuver in a suit, and it is its own language. So if you really care about wearing a suit well, wear it every chance you get so that you're comfortable with it. Don't and wear it, but make sure you're wearing it in appropriate situations, and in part just to get your mind into that mindset. It works for any kind of clothing. It is a language. People will judge you by what you wear, by how comfortable you are in it. And, you know, if, by the way, let's just a swimsuit model isn't comfortable in a swimsuit, you're going to notice. You know, and it's like you can tell who belongs in it and who doesn't. It's, again, it communicates whether you intend it to or not. There you go.
All right. Well, I can tell that you are comfortable wearing a suit and being in front of a camera, because that was an excellent segue into what I think we're going to be talking about this evening, which is how you carry yourself and communicate to other people when you're having conversations about belief or non-belief or religion or philosophy. So well done with that segue, and I cannot wait to get into it. You know, when we were talking before the show, you were telling me that talking about compassion is one of your favorite topics, and I want to know more about that. Why is that so important, and why should that be important to us as we're thinking about having conversations about belief or doubt?
Compassion is that I can tell one of the few things that makes life worth living. I hang out in the philosophy circles for obvious reasons. You already gave my CV. I've always been interested in philosophy. The Water Thief is actually, it's science fiction, but it's a rebuttal to Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. And it actually, if you haven't read Atlas Shrugged, you can still read the book, so on and so forth. But if you have, and if you know anything about neoliberal economics, if you know anything about the economics of the last, there's actually, I'll give away a little bit. There's one of the scenes, there is somebody talking about how he wants to fleece a grandmother for all her rent money and yada. And he goes on for a little bit, and there's this little soliloquy about it. That soliloquy, yeah, it's plagiarized. But now, I didn't get permission, but it's taken directly from the Enron tapes. And it was what one of the Enron executives had said about fleecing. So I had actually incorporated that. And so people say, people would never say that. Yeah, that was literally from the court documents. So I like to hang out in philosophy circles, and I like to talk and think about these things. People always ask, how do you have morality if you don't have religion? First of all, if you're going to talk to somebody even about that, it helps to try to have empathy, at least. And I think empathy and compassion aren't the same thing, but they're very closely related. And I think having compassion for people who are either trying to leave or who are completely enmeshed in their religion helps you to communicate with them, helps them to understand and respect you. And when we talk about ethics that exists outside of a religious construct, what we're talking about is we would not be the dominant species on the planet if we didn't have, as part of our evolutionary chain, a sense of how to work together in groups, which includes but not limited to having at least a modicum of respect for the rules, if for no other reason than enlightened self-interest. But the question is, are there other reasons besides enlightened self-interest? And I think for many people there are. And I think it's the people who have that compassion who make the world worth living for, who are a step above the just, well, I don't steal because that's the social contract, but the people who actually engage. We all remember the teacher who took a little extra time or said something a little extra nice for us. We all remember the person who could have done us damage in some way and chose not to, not for ethical reasons or this or that, but because they had compassion. We did on In Time a show on Fred Rogers, and I think he's phenomenally important. And a lot of people sit there and say, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, that guy? And it's like, okay, how much have you done with your life that has positively affected other people who will also go on to affect others? Now take a look at this guy who approached the entire world with compassion, who did a show where he and a black man both put their feet into a wading pool at a time when that was like, oh my God, he did not just do that, right? And that compassion has made the world a better place for so many people. So I think compassion improves your ability to communicate. It often, not always, sometimes you get hostility back. Sometimes people hate, some people really dislike compassion, a lot of reasons for it, but you can get in trouble with it. But sometimes it gets reflected back at you, which is always a nice thing. And I think in general, even if you're not aware of how it makes the world a better place, in general it does, and there are very few absolutes in this universe, but I think one of them is that compassion as a net improves life for absolutely everybody.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I can't think of very many times that I've gotten myself into trouble by being compassionate, whereas I can think of plenty of times that I've gotten myself into trouble by being a jerk. So let's go with your plan.
Also, too, this was a question in the chat, but I want to ask it because this is the topic we're talking about. What is your specific definition of compassion?
Oh, that's a good question. You'd think, again, I always do the philosophy stuff, so I try never to say a word I don't have a definition for right off the top of my head. I don't know that I have one, so I'll try to construct one roughly. Empathy is the ability to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. Compassion, I think, is a step beyond that, where you are able to put yourself in where they'll be in the future. And say that for no reason but for its own sake, you wish to find a way to improve that. So I think I loosely, I think I'm going to go with that definition. I don't know if that's adequate, but that's off the top of my head. I think that's where I'm going to start.
No, I think
that's a great answer.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer, because I didn't ask what the definition was. I asked for your definition. So, See?
But I still don't have a definition. I guess I can make up some. So, compassion is the outermost layer, just above the ozone, but below the terra zone. Right as you get to outer space, there is, I can just make up a definition now, right? So let me
think. Perfect.
I'm a writer. Yeah. I can do this.
Okay. You have a very creative mind, Nick. So, that's why I asked you here. Yes.
I'm gonna derail for 1 second. My wife goes to conferences, all PhDs, all this other stuff, but they always pick these conferences in great locations like Hawaii, stuff like that. So I get to go along because then it's basically a vacation. But I start to get bored and I figure this is a professional conference. Well, what's my profession? I make up stuff, right? I'm a writer. I write fiction. Okay, fine. So one day I went down to the they had a office set up there. You know, you print out documents. I changed my thing from, Nick Suter guest to Nick Suter NSA. So I just started walking around. People like, you're with the NSA? And I was just like, yeah, I wasn't really supposed to say that. No, I'm really here in an unofficial capacity. Don't worry about it. And just kept going on and on. Just, finally I sit down for lunch one day. Some guy sits down and says, you're with the NSA. Actually, it was CIA. The first one was, so I pick a new identity for each one. And like all of her lab partners, like, hey, have you ever been a cosmonaut? I was like, oh, no, I should do that. And I figure it's really a great way to practice my skill at being creative with characters. So I thought it was a professional thing. I was never invited back, but what can you do?
I mean, we don't know that it was because of that reason that you weren't invited
back. Oh, she made it clear. She made it crystal clear.
Oh. That was the reason.
At least there was feedback.
At least that sounds on brand for you. So I'm not surprised.
Oh, that's funny. Okay, I can see how you're fun at a party I can already tell.
Well, thank you.
Kara, I know that we have more questions asked, but I think we should show the poll results.
Yeah.
Before we go deeper into the talk so we can get Nick's reaction.
Let's do that now. That's a great idea. Yeah. So these are the poll results. So, and I'll read them aloud for anybody that is listening. We had question number one was, if you could Thanos snap religion away, in other words, eliminate it completely, would you? And 40% of people said yes, 40% said no, and 20% said not sure. And then question two, should you actively try to deconvert people from their religion if you don't believe in it? And I'm not surprised by the answer we got, given, you know, this is recovering from religion. Only 4% of people said, yes, you should. 32% of people said, no, you should not. 60% of people said, maybe in some cases. And 4% were not sure. Okay. Interesting. Nick, I want to get your reaction, and I also want to hear some people's comments in the chat. If you were, if you want to tell us more detail about your answer, please do. So Nick, what do you think? These were your questions. How do those responses strike you?
First question was posed by Reverend Douglas Wilson to Christopher Hitchens. They were in the back of a limousine. They had been doing debate after debate after debate, and the whole thing was recorded in a documentary called Collision. It's a pretty good documentary. I like it. Wilson is a difficult human being and was a very difficult upon Hitchens' death, unfortunately. So I am not a fan of the man. But he posed this question, and it was a good question. Hitchens thought about it, and then he said, no, I wouldn't. And you could tell he didn't even know why he was giving that answer, but he was compelled to be honest. And so and he even said later, he goes, I don't know why. He's just like, wait a minute, given what I profess to believe, he's like, shouldn't be my answer. So I think that's very interesting. I would be curious, you know, like doing a study or something and figuring out the hows of the why, yes or no. I think the more people who thought about it, many of those yeses would turn to noes. But I understand the yes, it really comes down to values. And it's not even values of like, do you value compassion or this or that, because you can be compassionate on both sides. In 1992, Pope John Paul II decided that he was going to make the largest mission in the history of the Catholic Church, and he was going to convert the entire continent of Africa. It was the most successful mission in human history. At that point, the AIDS rate in Africa was roughly the same as it was everywhere else in the world. Poverty rate was not all that bad. Starvation rate was not wildly out of control. And all of that changed when the catechisms of the church, including but not limited to, may not use condoms or any form of family planning. Now we are at the point where a child starves to death in Africa every 7 seconds in the hands of Christian parents. When you see that and you see the damage done, and people always say, oh, well, religion is responsible for all wars, which isn't even close to true. They're responsible for a very small percentage of them. But it is still responsible for a huge amount of hate, suffering. We would hate anyway, so it's not to say that getting rid of it would solve all of these things, but it certainly empowers people to feel justified in hate when there's actually no justification. That's kind of the point of religion, is to be able to make claims without the justification. And when you take a look at the suffering, including done by the Catholic Church, and you say to yourself, if I snapped my fingers and got rid of all religion, wouldn't the world be a better place? The answer is yes, absolutely yes. But the amount of suffering of people who truly believe, of people who couldn't function unless they felt that they would see their children who died in a car accident, that they would see them again someday. What about those people? And so what you realize is it really isn't as simple. The people who say, yes, I completely get it. I completely get it, because that is in fact a compassionate answer, but it's compassionate on a different scale and with a different set of values. People who say no, very compassionate answer. Think of the damage you're going to, and it's real damage that you're doing to real people just by getting rid of it. I lean towards the no. And the reason is because I am not God, and I don't know what the effect would be. And there is also something to be said for us as a species grappling with this and learning to overcome it ourselves, to climb out of the dark ages ourselves. We have had to earn the knowledge that we've gotten so far, and I think we may have to earn the ability to get out of religion on our own. But whether we do or don't, I don't think the Thanos snapping it away is a good idea, despite the horrific harm it has done. That's my answer to the first one.
By the way,
for co-hosts who planned on talking this show, they can talk a lot. Apologies.
No, my kind of feeling on this is, even as an anti-theist, as an atheist activist, I would not want to take away religion away, because also when I'm eliminating that person's ability to make a choice, and I don't want to take choice away from other people. Two, as you said, I don't know what would happen. I don't know if it's going to leave a vacuum in people's lives that does give them meaning, that it's going to cause trauma, because we talk about religious trauma a lot on, you know, these talks, but the trauma, like taking away my mom's religion would devastate her. I don't agree with the Catholic Church. I left it, but it would traumatize my mom, because this is something that she's ingrained in for 92 years. And if that goes away, a lot of her identity goes away. And for us to just snap our fingers and take away choice and their person's identity and the way that they socialize is not up to us. It has to be up to the individual to want to go through the journey. And I don't want to take that away from somebody else.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point too. You know, I hate this idea of, you know, the, you know, secular non-believers running around trying to take people's joy away from them. You know, you're trying to take Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy and Jesus. Like, no, it's okay. You know, maybe some people just, you know, want to have a little magic in their life, and, you know, maybe that's not always harmful. It certainly is in some cases, but doesn't necessarily.
Like, if I could get rid of the harm religion does, that would be that would be a different conversation.
Yes. And that's what I was noticing a lot of people in the chat were discussing too, saying, you know, well, what do you mean by religion? Is it the, you know, extra fundy, restrictive, harmful, trauma inducing religious practice? Or is it, you know, someone feeling a little spiritual when they're out in nature or something like that? You know, maybe there's a degree of difference there that's important. So also an interesting point.
You brought up another really good point. I did want to say this, which is the thing I hate most about theistic religions, and I use that differently than most people do nowadays. I'm using that in a classical sense. The thing I hate most about it is that it explicitly says that the people who believe in those religions are not only empowered, but often commanded to tell others how to live, and that because they know best, they're going to tell others what to do. That's what I dislike most about it. When I've talked to other atheists and anti-theists, that's usually what they say. So my question is this: how can you answer yes on that poll and not be that which we have condemned?
Ooh, interesting. That's a great point.
Oh, that's
okay, we'll have to think on that one. And, you know, we talked a little bit about that last week too, this kind of tendency to sometimes leave the belief but take the way of thinking with you to the next dogma or the next set of beliefs, and that's not particularly helpful in many cases. Well, and I think you also brought up another good point a minute ago. Actually, both of y'all were kind of touching on this, which kind of leads into the second question, this idea that also, you know, taking away religion can be really painful for people. You are really losing something in some cases if you deconvert or lose your faith in something. So do you want to comment on that or the answers to the second question at all, Nick, which was, should you actively try to deconvert people from their religion?
I believed I was a healer. I believed God was working through me, and I was perfectly cool with that, by the way, which is funny because later, you know, so I like to say there was no ego involved. There was at no time did I think I was doing this, But you can't think something like that without thinking there's got to be ego, right? Because God has chosen to work through you. That feels, as Sam Harris would say, uncommonly good. But there was never any time that I even wanted the credit. I was just so delighted to be able to help people and all this other stuff. And a healer, not like physical, but like I found that I could talk to people and I could make them feel better. But if I listened to that voice in my head, which it turned out everybody has and was just just me. And I didn't want that. I wanted... I was very comfortable with the idea that my family would never die. I would see all of them again. I didn't ask too many questions about like, what if one of them ends up going downstairs and I go upstairs, you know, but so I deconverted about 23 years ago, roughly. There has not been a day in my life that I have not missed religion. Not a day, not a day. My father died about 2 years ago. And I remember when I first really became aware that someday he would not be in my life. And I was okay with it because it was just not in this life I would see him again. And when I had children who were born, that's when I missed religion the most because I realized someday I'm going to be separated from these children. And there's nothing I can do about it. So I miss religion absolutely every single day. And the reason I felt compelled to deconvert was because I realized I was causing harm. I wasn't trying to. I was trying to help people, but because I didn't always know what I was talking about, but I thought I did because the voice is God and God's never wrong. And so I said, you know, as much as it's important to me to be able to live the life I want to live, the universe, I noticed, doesn't bend to what I want. And reality is reality regardless. That is one reason. The very first person I ever tried to deconvert, and we'll talk about the trying because that was the second question. I spoke with him for a very long time, not a very long time, a couple weeks, but I met him on Facebook and he lived in a trailer in, I think, Australian desert or something like that. And one day, and you know, I was very patient. I also saw it as an exercise in patience, which was its own reward. And one day he said, "We have to stop talking." I said, "Why?" And I mean, he can disengage anytime he wants to, but I was curious. It was just sudden. He said, "Because I'm starting to worry you might be right." I was just like, "Well, why does that mean we have to stop talking?" He said, "I used to be married, had a kid. My wife left me, took the kid. None of the female species," and I say, he said species. That's what he said, female species. That's who I was talking to. "None of the female species will talk with me. I've been shunned by everyone. I'm a 300-pound fat guy who can't get away from his computer. Mm-hmm. The only reason I don't eat a gun is because it's against the Bible." And I realized instantly what he was saying, which was I basically succeeded in deconverting him. But, and that's when a couple of things happened for me. The first thing that happened was I realized I'm playing with live ammunition. there are consequences to the things I do, and there are, and it's so easy. I watch, this is what gets back to compassion. Mm-hmm. I watch interactions online, and I have you know, what they call a sock account, you know, a fake account to see some accounts on occasion, but I don't use sock accounts to interact with people. I don't talk to people on sock accounts or fake accounts, and there's a couple of reasons for this, but one reason why I've always had my real name on that account is so that I don't get tempted to become an asshole. That's not true. I did at one point have a sock account. I started to engage people and I could tell myself that I was more hostile, more aggressive on that account because I could get away with it because there were no consequences for it. I hated that I could see that. I thought I was above it, right? I said, "No, if it's anonymous, I can still be me." I thought so, but when I looked at what I was like, this isn't the other me. But you look at people who say the worst things to just text on a screen, and they don't realize that they're talking to someone else and they don't care. And Henry David Thoreau, no, Jesus.
Was it Jesus?
Well, Wadsworth Longfellow.
Great oh author, God. By the way.
Really, 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 really.
I couldn't resist.
Henry David Jesus.
Jesus said, no, this is cooler than what Jesus said, by the way. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. If we could read the secret histories of our enemies, we would find in there enough suffering and sorrow to disarm all hostility. That's not always true. There are sociopaths, but that's true far more often than not. We're all fighting secret battles that other people don't know about. And when a mom gets pissed because her daughter didn't make the cheerleading team, so she creates a fake account, goes on a Facebook, harasses that cheerleader. And then that girl commits suicide. I didn't know. You're right, you didn't know. But all of us have bad days. And if you pile on at the wrong time, even to the most stout person, it isn't as hard as it might seem to treat everybody with compassion as much as possible. And it often feels good, especially if you see some fruits of it. And you don't always, and there are people who take advantage of it. Period, end of discussion. I would rather be me than be anything else. So when that guy had said, the only reason I don't need a gun is because the Bible, so I realized, I was like a little happy because I was like, it worked. I did deconvert. I was, because the only reason to make that argument is if his faith was just about gone. But then I realized too, I was like, okay, what kind of person am I? I was like, it's not worth winning the fight for this guy where he is. And I was always of the, I have to win every fight. I have to win every argument. And I was just like, no, I have to think about this. And so I disengaged with him. And then I realized I don't in general engage unless somebody's being a bully. In which case, in my view, that is inviting, that is giving your consent. I don't engage with people on theism unless they consent in one way or another. If they ask me a question, that's consent. If they say, why are you an atheist? Or can I talk to you about Jesus? Sure, let's talk about you. Boom, they just gave consent and I can now try to deconvert them. I'm happy to do it. If they don't, and it doesn't, if they say, I want to talk about Jesus, that's not consent. You can talk to me about Jesus. And if you want to tell me why you love Jesus, I will sit and listen. That's fine. That's absolutely fine. And I won't question it. But if you say, gee, Nick, what do you think? Don't ask that unless you really want the answer.
Don't ask questions you don't want to know the answer to. Yeah.
Yep. Because we've all done that, and then we've all regretted it.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So I have a question. So when we're talking about religion, and we're especially religions that are very fundy, they might have like hate backed into them, like, you know, queer people are icky, you know, they're sinners, females can't talk in the church, you know, all this type of stuff. And it can be difficult for people to hear these messages and still realize the people that are saying them are human beings. So at what level do we offer compassion but also condemnation?
I'm sorry, could you give the example again?
So if we have like the Jehovah's Witnesses, okay, which we know are very extreme. They do shunning, and there's been a lot of scandals and really bad stuff that's found out about Jehovah's Witnesses.
I'm familiar, yeah.
Yeah, we're all familiar. Mm. Yeah, we're smart people around here. So my question is, when do you offer compassion, and then when does that give way to condemnation, and how do you balance the two?
Because I'm a writer, I answer most questions in stories. I should have told you that at the beginning. Can I answer this one? My grandfather was a surgeon in World War II. He was at the Battle of the Bulge. He flew in on a glider into the city of Bastong. They had no medical support of any kind, and he performed surgery for 48 hours straight without anesthesia. I was talking to him about this later, and he talked to me about cutting off somebody's leg without anesthesia. And I asked how he had done that. And he said, compassionately, you compassionately cut off somebody's leg? It's like, yeah, because if I didn't do it, he was going to die. And if I didn't do it then, and if I waited for his permission, and if I just said, well, you know, let's talk about it. During that conversation, six other people were going to die. I didn't have time. I wanted to save as many lives as possible. That's how it was done. And sometimes, actually, believe it or not, ruthlessness can be compassion. That's an example of it. I used to take Aikido. That was something one of my Aikido teachers used to say, which was that you could actually be compassionate and ruthless at the same time. It really depends on what your goals are and your motives are. I detest Donald J. Trump. I truly believe that he is about as close to anything that could end the Republic as anyone we've ever seen. Having said that, never once wished him dead. I have friends who wish him dead, and they're like, oh my God, Nick, you're so, you won't wish him dead. I was like, no, because all of us are going to face that. That's something we all have in common. And for the most part, all of us are terrified of it. I don't wish it on anybody. But I think he has to be stopped. And I think he has to be stopped with every legitimate means at your disposal. And you have to be ruthless about it. You can't stop. You can't stop contesting when he says these things. You can't stop educating people. You can't stop. And when people say, I don't want to hear anymore, guess what? I'm inserting myself because this is a conversation that has to be had. And that's the same thing with, too, by the way, LGBTQ, civil rights, women's rights. You know, if you don't want to have the discussion, then go home and then you're going to vote however you're going to vote. But if you're going to be in a public square and you're going to even suggest to me that you're on the wrong side of that issue, I'm going to engage and I'm going to be ruthless about doing that. But I'm going to do it with compassion and recognizing that not all people who are against LGBTQ are evil. Not all theists are evil. So I can be ruthless in attacking corruption and attacking ideas that are damaging to us while recognizing that those ideas are held by human beings who share a great many things in common with me, not the least of which is I've had some pretty shitty ideas in my life too. So maybe we can be ruthless in engaging and making sure that what I truly believe are the right values win, but we do it with compassion.
I really like that. I think that's a great point because, you know, as somebody that came from the very fundy, hate-based religious background, I have in the past had a lot of very problematic views, or views that I would find very problematic now. And I didn't change. Well, I changed my mind on a lot of things, but I don't think that, you know, I was a horrible person and then I became suddenly smarter and more enlightened. I
mean, You're enlightened, Kara.
I did learn new things and that was helpful, but it wouldn't have been very effective at that time in my life to tell me, well, you're a horrible person. You think this because you're an awful person. That probably wasn't the reason. I thought that because I was indoctrinated as a child to think that and hadn't had the opportunity to have conversations where I learned new information. And that's a great way to shut down a conversation is to insult somebody.
I think so too. Like, this is something that I come back to is that I can't see all ends. So I don't think it's going to happen, but Donald Trump might have a change of heart. He might grow as a person. Listen, I'm just saying, as an extreme example, it might happen. No,
that's true. I might win the lottery 16 times in a row. You never know. Okay, please continue.
But what I'm saying
Helen and I do not have an opinion on political parties or candidates.
We do not, but I'm just using this as an example that nobody can see all ends. So if you go around wishing death on people that you don't like, and yes, there's a lot of buttheads in the world. I 100% agree. And I fight against those buttheads, but then you're eliminating the choice that they might get better. And there have been neo-Nazis that have gotten better and fight against neo-Nazism. There have been racists who have gotten better and fight against racism. There are sexists who got better and fight against sexism. So you shouldn't feel like, well, this person's a butthead, they deserve to die. You don't know the end. And you're taking away choice. And I'm not a big fan of taking away choice, even if someone's being a terrible person. You know, just saying.
I'm looking for my
Did I just go on a rant and my mic was off?
Well, What I wanted to do was I'm just trying to look up the definition of butthead. So I'm just that's all.
That's right. It is important to define our terms.
Exactly. Yeah, I had to define compassion. I think you needed to define butthead if you're going to use that term. This name.
Gauntlet has been thrown down. I love having conversations with philosophers because you can have the whole conversation for an hour trying to iron out the definition of the thing you're going to have a conversation about.
Pandemic assholes.
I know too many philosophers would like
to have these conversations.
Yeah, you're still arguing about the terms and the parameters. You don't actually get to the argument itself until maybe next time.
I think that's a little unfair. So just to clarify, could you define terms for me before we continue, and then I can see whether I agree with you or not.
Well, first I need you to tell me if you're going to be approaching this from a theoretical perspective, or which particular theoretical perspective are you applying here?
So I'm gonna approach this from a pragmatic ontological perspective.
Oh, we're discussing ontology then.
Yes.
Okay, I'm out.
Thank God, because I was just like, how much more am I going to have to bluff my way through this one?
I have found ontology is the point where I can bluff for about one paragraph, and then it becomes apparent that no one has the same idea about what that word means.
Listen, don't get me started. The number of people who abuse the word epistemology. Epistemology is the search for truth and or what is truth? How do you define truth? What does it mean when you say something is true? People cannot have their own epistemology. You can't say, well, my epistemology. No, epistemology is a method. That's like saying my science. No, your science is the same as everybody else. Okay, fine. You know what? That's it. Pet peeve. I'm triggered. Yeah. I'm triggered.
Okay.
Hold on.
I'm going to go off on a brief derailment here too and tell you I got the best answer to this question. One time I just straight up asked my advisor in grad school, I said, can you please tell me what these words mean and what is the difference between epistemology and ontology? And he was brilliant. And he said something to the effect of basically epistemology is how you think things are and ontology is how you think things should be. And I was like,
Is it possible he said what things are? Well, no.
Yes.
You remember.
Yeah, that is probably what he said, is what things are. And ontology is how you think they should be. And I'm paraphrasing badly. He said something brilliant, and I've turned it into something that's like complete garbage. But it condensed it down well.
It sounds smart. You get it. It sounds smart.
It was great. I said it to a room full of other PhDs and they went, ooh.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to, there's gotta be a good one. Because people ask me all the time, I can give a 4 or 5 sentence answer for it, but not something that good.
Yeah, it was good. I'm gonna look up my notes later because I would just generally go into his office and write down everything he said because I was like, it's gonna be good. I'm gonna need this later. So I'll find my notes later and get exactly what I've said. But I think it is that. He said it's what things are and then how it should be. Okay, anyway, we're done defining the terms. That's the end of that conversation for this evening's discussion.
I mean, do you want me to look up the definition of butthead?
No, I just noticed that the person I said, I'd like you to define the terms, the term said, no, we're done defining terms, but I don't know what we're done defining because she hasn't defined terms yet. So this is fine. Let's just, obviously words don't even have meaning in this discussion. Let's just, whatever you guys want to talk about.
Listen, we're making up our own words and definitions.
That's crystal clear.
Because, by the way, everything's made up.
Language is a social construct.
Okay. Yep.
There we go.
Am I even speaking English right now?
Depends on your perspective. Okay, moving on to communicating compassionately. Okay, actually, I had a question. I wanted to talk to you about that. I think when we were talking earlier, we both discussed how we really enjoyed listening to and reading Christopher Hitchens, who is actually one of my favorite authors too. I think the man was brilliant. He could turn a phrase in a quick, witty retort that I wish I could sit down for a month and compose. Brilliant. But you mentioned, and I agree, that perhaps compassionate communication was not his strong suit. Do you have thoughts on this?
He said a couple of things which I absolutely abhorred, not many. One of them was when he, and you can see he actually got triggered. He was talking about his atheist friends who say they miss religion, much like a missing limb, like phantom pain. And he's like, oh, I don't get this at all. I don't know. And he was really kind of triggered about that one. And that always shocked me, because I think you have to have a significant lack of imagination to not understand why this could be appealing. And I've seen a lot of atheists who are like, well, I don't want to be a slave to a god and this and that. I was like, well, yeah, except when you look at it through their worldview, that's not really what it is. And in the same way that so many theists have a hard time understanding that you can have morality that isn't grounded in metaphysical, some kind of metaphysical ontology, just to sound smart. I find it so odd, like, you know, like, well, how could you know there be a god with all the babies dying? Well, let's just assume hypothetically that you know, all those babies die, their souls go up to heaven, and they say, oh man, I was on this ride called Planet Earth, ended badly, I'm gonna go back and try again, maybe I'll do better, yada yada yada. And like, well, no religion believes that. Well, some do, and you don't know. And what I found too is everybody has their own beliefs. There's 1 point, or how many billion Christians? I think 2 billion Christians on this planet. Yeah, there isn't 2 billion Christians, because none of them believe the same version of Christianity as any of the others. And in fact, most of them think most of the others are going to hell, even of the same denomination. So, we, even as a theist, we pick and choose our beliefs. They're not assigned to us by God or by the Bible or anything else, and we take the ones that make sense to us. How could that be any other way? So, dear Lord, I think I just lost my train of thought. Oh yeah, Hitchens. So, I can understand why it's so appealing to so many people. And when you can pick and choose your beliefs, and that's really what people do, they don't realize consciously that's what they're doing. That's what they're doing. Well, of course you're going to like it. So I was distressed by not only his lack of compassion in that for atheists who missed their belief, and the number of atheists I see who feel that way, but also some lack of compassion towards theists in general, but for the fact that I saw many interviews with theists who said that he wasn't like that in person, and that, you know, any theist could come and eat at his dinner table. And Penn Jillette talked a lot about Hitchens and talked about how that he really, in person, he was very magnanimous, and he really didn't ask people about their religion, and he didn't challenge people about it, and didn't, you know, any of that other stuff. Some of it is showmanship, and some of it is he's targeting a very specific audience, but that audience isn't actually individuals. He's trying to target a system, and he's trying to, and one of the things I noticed, you know, he had some pretty unkind things to say about Pat Robertson. I should have waited. I saw you drinking. I was like, you're really going to say that? Because I knew you knew what I was talking about.
I almost spit that out.
he was not a fan. He was really not a fan. But that's Pat Robertson. That's a guy who's made a tremendous amount of money, and I think quite arguably, by ripping people off and doing some pretty horrible things. I never saw him go out and say, yeah, I met a minister. What a shithead. What a horrible human being. No, the people that he attacked were people who could defend themselves. And it was about taking them down a couple of notches and seeing that it could be done. And it takes all kinds. There are people who approach this with a kind of aggressiveness and anger that I don't like. And yet every now and then, somebody that the compassion doesn't work for, they hear and see that, and it actually works with them. So there's no right or wrong way to communicate. There are ways that in general are, in my view, are more effective. But there are some people that don't respond to that. Just like, it's almost like medicine, right? You know, there are people who don't respond to certain meds, and there are other people who respond to the last med that you would ever give somebody for whatever that condition is, and somehow it works. So it takes all kinds, for as long as we keep our motives as pure as we can. Proselytize my view, which is as much compassion as possible. Hitchens I think had more of that than he showed. He was going after Al Sharpton. He was going after Wilson. He was going after William Lane Craig and all of the others. These are all people who can defend themselves. He never kicked somebody when they were down that I could tell. I may be wrong, but as someone who's very familiar with his work. So yeah, I think when you talk about compassion and his lack of it, that he was, by the way, a guy who donated blood quite frequently. And I think really was a humanist and did care about people. So anyways, that's my answer to the pigeons problem.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that perspective. I'm glad to know some of that information because I actually do really enjoy a lot of his work. And even though, you know, maybe it's has some things about it that could be problematic in some ways, I think it did have value as well. And so I'm glad to hear that additional information that you said about, you know, he was maybe perhaps a little selective in sort of punching up, not punching down, you know, kind of approach. That may be a sort of cliche way to say it, but that's, yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the point you've touched on a few times already, but you kind of mentioned this, dealing with the fact that, you know, a lot of people, if deconverting from a faith can come with a lot of costs. It can come with a lot of grief and a lot of pain. And how do we take that into account in ourselves and in our dealings with other people? Do you have any recommendations?
I would love to answer that question. There was another question, and there was a correction. Yeah, it was Jerry Falwell. And I remember now it was Jerry Falwell. Now, So I think I was thinking about Robertson because Robertson just died. But yeah, it was Falwell. And his comment was about Falwell when he was cremated. So it was definitely Falwell. Yeah, it was. So I did misspeak. Thank you for the correction. But there was a question about not being a doormat, and that's such an important one. So I do want to get to that one, but I want to just handle these in order. So the question you asked, I'm sorry, I forgot the question you just asked.
There's a lot of questions.
Either one. We've got plenty of questions. Yeah, you can answer the doormat one, or the one I was asking was just, you know, how do we take into account in our conversations with ourselves and with other people? How do we deal compassionately with the fact that we have kind of two conversations going on? One is whether or not this belief system may be true and accurate or harmful versus what you're losing and the fact that you're grieving potentially if you lose it.
Two skills that are very important, applying charity when talking to people. So trying to make sure that you're taking things in the way that they were meant and that you're not jockeying for position. Because while you're busy jockeying for position, you're not listening. And that's the second skill, which is active listening. So it's listening to what they're saying and trying to understand, A, what they're saying, and B, what they mean, which is two very, very different things. We say what we mean less than 50% of the time. In fact, we probably say what we mean about 20% of the time. Now, that's okay because we still all get it. My father was a criminal defense attorney. So, I mean, I used to argue at the dinner table all the time, and you had to say things accurately. And I think I naturally enjoyed that anyway. That's why I went into philosophy. My peeps, lawyers, my peeps, mostly for just how they talk, believe it or not. My wife comes up to me and says, hon, would you mind unloading the dishwasher? I say, no. She says, okay, thanks. And she walks away because she knows I'm going to unload the dishwasher. Why? Well, a couple things about that statement, would you mind unloading the dishwasher? First of all, it's actually got an implied second element to it, which is a request to unload the dishwasher, which she actually didn't say, but is nonetheless implied. But I usually answer what people ask, not what they meant, because I try very hard not to guess at what people meant. And what she asked was, would I mind unloading it? The answer to that is no, I would not mind unloading it. And since I wouldn't mind unloading it, and I know that there was an implied, would I please unload it? The answer to that is also implied, yes, I will unload it. Same thing with the salt.
You sound like my husband, because when I ask him questions like that, I go, would you mind unloading the dishwasher? He goes, yes, I mind. but I'll do it anyway. And I'm like, I'm like, fine. I'm like, he does it all the time. And I'm like, you pandemic asshole.
Yep. Yeah.
He's a philosopher. That's what his degree's in. So of course.
I'm a lucky man. I am very aware that I am lucky that there is anyone in the female species that would put up with that. But
we are not using that term here.
Female
species. I'm a species.
It's what we in the biz call a callback. At any rate, so I try very hard to be as precise as possible when speaking, and I try to listen very carefully to what they say, and as they're saying it, make sure that the words mean roughly what I think they mean. If they don't, try to ask for clarification. And if later I get that clarification, I don't sit there and say, oh, they're clarifying now because they've been losing the argument and they want to change the terms. I say, okay, no, that's fine, but we may then need to readdress something to avoid equivocation of things. If we're talking about faith, I always get the definition of faith up front. They can define it anyway. Why should I be the one who gets to define faith if I'm trying to have a quote good faith discussion with somebody? They can define it any way they want. Everybody objects to how the religious people define faith. No, that's not true. Nobody objects to it. What people object to is when they define it 2, 3, or 4 different ways in the same sentence, and they do that equivocation to change the meaning and get around. That's what we object to. Let them define it any way they want to. And I'm not doing this because I'm trying to score points like, hey, I even let you define. No, I'm doing it because it's going to ease communication. If they can define it any way they want, and I take it on their terms, I don't care and then we'll use it their way. I give them as much as possible. I make sure that I enforce my boundaries, which include, you are not allowed to change the definitions while we're talking. If it's a different kind of faith, use a different word. Maybe it's blind faith, or maybe it's this or that, but you can't use the same word. And so make sure I enforce those rules of civil discourse and give as much charity as possible. And actively listen. If you start to detect signs of stress, if you start to realize that you don't understand the conversation anymore, right? So we're talking, so faith is important to you, person I'm talking to. Well, of course it's important to me. I think it's important to all people. All right, well, what do you think faith is? Well, faith is one of those things like my grandmother and that car accident, but I didn't say it then, but I'm saying it now. And it's like, okay, that's what we call a non sequitur. Her brain just went somewhere else. And this person that I'm speaking with has a very specific issue that has nothing to do with the larger topic. And my first instinct is, ooh, let's engage and figure out what the fuck happened with her grandmother. That is not healthy. And you don't know what harm you're doing. And you won't have a positive conversation at this point because all of this is enmeshed in something that probably happened recently. There's trauma there. So now I know to disengage and to do it with as much compassion as possible. Oh, wow, your grandmother. I had no idea. Thank you so much for talking to me today. I'm really glad we talked. Thank you. And then pull out and mean it, because it's not that hard to actually be glad. You don't have to, if you're not glad, this is a good question. Should you make it up and say that you are? I usually find that I am glad that people were willing to give me a little time and that. And so I just say, yeah, thank you for your time. And I move on. That's it. And you can do that if you're paying attention. And if you catch the signs that you're treading somewhere you shouldn't be treading, trust those instincts, get the fuck out. The world isn't going to end or be saved based on one deconversion or conversion or no, just be a good person, bail.
I like that. Just focusing on being a good person, not winning the argument.
And then there was another, how do you speak with compassion without being a doormat? Read Letter from a Birmingham Jail by Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., probably my most favorite person in the world, poster of him back there. I got that poster in the 8th grade, and I have had it with me in every room I've ever been in since. One of the most amazing human beings, and very hard for people to understand. And since I've been talking about the views that he espoused more recently, questions like this have come up because people sit there and I talk about compassion and I talk about being forgiving, and people mistake that for being passive. And they mistake that for not getting involved. In a letter from a Birmingham jail, he talks about that, where, you know, he's accused of, well, he gets accused of a lot of things. He gets accused, obviously, by some people of not doing enough and of others of doing too much. But certainly one of the accusations is that he's not doing anything, right? He's not advocating violence. He's not advocating overthrowing this terrible system. So what could he possibly be talking about? He talks about why that kind of thing doesn't work. And he talks about how when he goes and is told that he can't sit in a restaurant, and then he goes and he sits there anyway. And he knows he's going to get arrested, and he accepts the consequences of that. But he still went out and deliberately broke the law. He still was out actively doing these things. And he did it to create tension, which he said was, and people, he said, people say, shouldn't we negotiate? He goes, absolutely. Of course we should negotiate. That's the goal, is negotiation. But you can't negotiate with people who don't understand that there's a problem. So we are, he goes, we're here to highlight the problem, and then we can negotiate. He was a fan of negotiation. He was a fan of working with people. And we had talked about this earlier, right? The deists, you know, people who believe that there is a higher power, but they don't, you know, believe in, they don't believe it tells them to go out and stone gay people. Those people are so often allies to the anti-theist. I am an anti-theist. Again, classical sense, I don't object to all religion. Hitchens put this once beautifully. For the theist position, again, classical theism, and he came from Oxford University, that's the definition he was using. You have A, belief in a higher power. I don't care, fine. B, a belief that that higher power actually knows who you are, cares about what you do in your life, and is somehow connected to you and even talks to you. Fine, don't care about that either. C, that higher power has empowered you to tell other people how to live and or commanded you to do that. That's where I have the issue. I'm perfectly fine with A and B. None of my business at all. Go have fun. And even Hitchens also said he had no problem with that in his discussion with Al Sharpton. Another thing people didn't realize, he wasn't against the first two. Go ahead. He said, religion is people's favorite toys. Go ahead, play with those toys to your heart's content. It's when you try to make me and my children play with your toys. No. I think recognizing that everybody has rights, including you. Being compassionate doesn't mean abandoning your rights. Doesn't mean when somebody is being aggressive or hostile towards you, saying, oh, I'm going to be compassionate and not do anything. No, you deserve to have your rights defended too. And you deserve to stand up and you deserve to say, no, this is not acceptable. The question is, do you do it by taking out a gun? Or do you do it by saying, this is not acceptable, and come hell or high water, you will eventually understand that, however it's done. But the question is, so this is, for Martin Luther King Jr., it was, you know, we're going to do sit-ins. We're going to chain ourselves to doors. We're going to do all of these things. No violence. We're not going to hurt people. But we are going to draw everybody's attention to this. And when in Montgomery, Alabama, the chief of police set dogs on a 7-year-old girl. Should we have gone the Malcolm X approach and set everything on fire? I don't know. Was it worth the 7-year-old girl? She survived, but she was attacked by a dog. But when that aired, and every country in the world saw that, the outrage that America was so fucking ass backwards that this was even remotely acceptable and could be aired on television. He won on that day, and without any violence, and without ever even disrespecting the people who would do that kind of thing, because even them he treated with respect. And when people tell me, well, we'll never get anywhere, Mitch McConnell, you can't negotiate with Mitch McConnell. Yeah, you can't negotiate with a sheriff who's going to set dogs on a 7-year-old girl either. And yet, The last example I'll give is because everyone equates this to passivism. It's not passivism in that you're being passive. You're causing a lot of trouble, but you're doing it in a very specific way. treating people with compassion. I get asked this all the time. This is my favorite example. I love this example when people come up to me with this. They say, oh, well, if we had just said we're going to be nice to Germany during World War II, what would have happened? We'd all be speaking German right now. I am not saying that we shouldn't have fought Adolf Hitler in World War II. However, it proves my point. It proves my point. When Germany lost World War II, there were plenty of people who said, we need to strip Germany of everything, and Japan too. I remember the Bataan Death March. I remember Pearl Harbor. I remember, let's eliminate Japan. Instead, we said, no, we're going to treat them with compassion. We're going to treat Germany with compassion. Why? Because after World War I, we didn't do that. That is how Hitler came into power. It was us saying we're going to be punitive. We depressed the German economy so much that when a populist came out and said, hey, we all think we're shit and we're not, let's have some dignity. That's why he was elected. That's why Trump was elected. People have asked me, and I think Helen was there for this show, people have asked me how mm-hmm. Trump was elected. He was elected because liberals, including the man that I campaigned for, Barack Obama, passed healthcare using the Interstate Commerce Clause, which was an abuse of that clause. Now, at the time, I was thrilled. I was like, oh, that was clever. Well done, man. We're all going to have universal healthcare. But here's the thing. I get pissed when conservatives cheat the system. And if you're a conservative, that's cheating the system, because that was absolutely not what the Interstate Commerce Clause was designed to do. And John Boehner would sit there on the floor of the Senate and go, oh, no, you can't. Oh, no, you can't. At first, I was laughing my ass off. Like, who the fuck's he talking to? Hell yes, we did, motherfucker. What the fuck are you going to do about it? I was like, oh, that's what he's doing. He's getting the populace pissed off because the liberals just broke the fucking rules badly.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you approve of it or not, Donald Trump comes up and says, you know, liberals think that you're too stupid to understand healthcare. And he's right. That is what liberals think. A lot of liberals think that. Liberals think you need to be taken care of and you need to be told how to think. Yeah, a lot of liberals seem to think that too. Vote for me and I'm going to piss them off more than anybody you've ever seen. You think Republicans actually thought that this guy who literally shits on a golden toilet was a man of the people? Nobody thought that. They said that because that's how they could vote for him. They voted for him because he pissed off the liberals. That's what a lack of compassion from the left for the right. The left has loads of compassion for lots of people, except conservatives, it turns out, where there's less of it. And it's had repercussions. The reason we had to fight Hitler was because we did so much damage after World War I. It made conditions ripe for Hitler to come up and for World War II. And we said, we learned the first time, Germany, France gets to keep their dignity. And 50 years later, instead of another world war, they're amongst our closest allies.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot tell me this doesn't work on every scale, person to person, country to country.
My big thing too is that No, it's okay. Because like what I say, that compassion is radical, being kind is radical. Because when you have the entire world that says, like, hate these people, yes, hate these people, when you're coming from and this doesn't mean that you're not angry, because anger is your motivation. It motivates you to stand up for minoritized groups. It motivates you to have compassion and kindness for people that are different than you, and you still want them treated and to have equality. That's the whole point. Even people that you disagree with, you have to have that feeling of compassion, because that is the radical place to be. The hatred stuff is easy. The hatred stuff is just like, well, you're different than me, fuck you, you know, and I'm, you know, fuck you, I got mine. It takes more work to be compassionate and being kind. And that's the radical viewpoint, because that's what gets shit done. That's what helps people progress in society. And if you're not coming from a compassionate and kind place, you're coming from the places like, I hate you, fuck you, you don't deserve the same rights. And that's the problem, you know. And that's why I always say that compassion and kindness is the radical place to be. It is not being a doormat, it's standing up for your rights and for the rights of others.
I couldn't have said it any better. And there was a comment in the live chat, and I was about to say the name, and then I realized, oh, nope, no names. But there was a great comment that it really is hypocritical of the left. And that is why my credentials, everybody knows I'm on the left. I am absolutely on the left. I'm not ashamed to be on the left. I'm not a Democrat. I had to join the Democratic Party for the Obama campaign. I really tried to avoid that, but at the end I had to. And the reason is, there are plenty of people, the further you get on the left, the more it's like, all of a sudden, it's like I'm worse than somebody on the right, because I'm somebody on the left who deeply criticizes the left, especially how much it shits on people on the far right. The far right loves to stop genuine conversation by saying people on the left hate America and why don't you just leave? And people on the left say, oh, we'd never do that. Oh, no? Yeah, you wouldn't call anyone racist just for voting for Trump, would you? No, the left would never do that. We do it too. And that's another reason why I try not to do it, is because I don't like it when it's done to me. It's not fair when it's done to me, and it's not somebody who's really interested in honest dialogue. So if I'm interested in honest dialogue, first of all, I think it's worth being interested in. And if I am interested in it, it has to start with me being as compassionate as possible and as honest as possible going forward.
And I think that is a great way to sum it up. You said you didn't have necessarily a definition for compassion at the beginning, but I think that really was a good, you got there telling the story. And
I love it. Very authory of you, by the way, yes. Nick.
I talk in stories. And my wife used to love it. And then she's like, oh God, here we go. I know this is the story about when he almost fell off a cliff and was trying to impress a woman.
You remind me of my dad, because my dad cannot tell any moral or anything without a story attached to it. So I grew up with this. So I appreciate that about you, Nicholas, that you talk, because my dad cannot do anything without a story.
As a student of the social sciences, I feel compelled to point out, this is how people communicate best through stories. This is what helps us understand. Yes. Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah, the other thing is, I'm also, I didn't point this out part of my CV. I'm also a certified teacher. I'm certified to teach English and social studies, grades 4 through 8 and 9 through 12. It's two separate certifications. And I do teach high school. I haven't taught high school in a while. But as a teacher, as a licensed teacher, yes, that's, you are correct. As in terms of an educational model, that's a great way to do it. Doesn't work for everybody. Like I said, there's some medicines, there's some people who, oh fuck, he's got another story. He thinks those things are so charming. Just look at him smiling up there. Let me tell you a story. most of the time people appreciate it.
Yeah, well, we appreciate it, and we appreciate you being here, and we are about at the end, but before we wrap up and go to the Q&A, I want you to tell us just a little bit briefly about your other stories, plug your books and your show, tell us where people can find you.
Lord, I don't know.
Go for yourself, Nick, show.
Okay, here we go. So, yeah, I do a lot of stuff. The Humanist Codex is something I'd like to get back. It was a collection of arguments, basically all anti-theistic arguments, but it was designed to be read by theists and anti-theists alike. If you're a theist and you want to try to find a counter to a specific argument, you could find the best version of that argument here. And what the counters were, and it was, you could make your own curriculum because everything was hyperlinked to everything else. And you could even get a blog on it, a little bit like Pathos. When I started doing my show, I had to fund some money from that. And then it ended up getting, the website got wiped out. I got it back up, but like getting it working again. Anyways, first thing, this one, I would say, so The Water Thief, it was written as a rebuttal to Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. It is science fiction and got, best science fiction. I got silver from Clarion, which is like a literary magazine, got silver for science fiction book of the year for 2012. Got best of 2012 by Kirkus Reviews. It's got, if you go to the Amazon thing, you'll find that it made a lot of awards, which is really nice.
I love that it didn't when translate... authors, like, they receive awards and then they say, like, go check what award I won. I love it when people do that.
It's worse than that. Somebody was, I was on a show once and the guy ended every show with a quote from a book. And this show was about capitalism and compassion and capitalism. And he starts, he says, okay, as always, I'm going to end with a quote from a book. And he starts reading this quote. And I started listening to it. I said, that sounds familiar. Like, I know that. Okay, was that Roosevelt? Who the fuck was that? Was that, no, that wasn't, it couldn't have been Roosevelt. Who the fuck said that? Ooh, I like that line. It's like, you know what would make this perfect? And I'm always constructing and I'm deconstructing. So when I hear a speech, I'm always in my mind deconstructing how it could have been done better. I was like, you know what would make it perfect is if the next line it goes, and then the next line it goes exactly where I would have wanted it to go. I was like, God damn, I'm going to have to figure out who the fuck it is. So he finishes the whole thing. I was like, that was good. Who the hell? Nicholas Lamar Suter, The Water Thief. Like, oh, okay, that's why it was so familiar. I was like, oh, yeah, okay.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that so much.
I didn't say anything. I was like, oh, thank you.
I love human hubris. I do. I love it so much.
I love it.
So it's about, it's basically a world that is almost exactly what Ayn Rand would have wanted. And by the way, I don't dislike Ayn Rand. I think she's profoundly misunderstood. A lot of her ideas were great. They all rest on one assumption, which I think was false. I talk about it in the book, but nonetheless, I build the world exactly as she would, but I flip that assumption, and you come up with a dystopia. Absolutely everything is, there's no such thing as law anymore. All there is contracts and value. So if you want to take a gun, shoot somebody in the head and kill them, you go right ahead, but you will owe the business that owns them the money that for their future profits and all that other stuff. So air is sold. If you want to smoke, you can, but if you do damage to your lungs, the company that owns you has to be compensated. So you have to be able to pay for it. So there's no laws. It's just contracts, corporations, yada, yada, yada. So that's it. It's a complete neoliberal utopia, I suppose. But anyways, just where would that go? There's a woman who's stealing water out of the air, and the protagonist realizes that he could make so much more money. He makes money if he can turn her in, but he'd make much more money if instead of her just stealing the water, he's just like, she's secretly giving it to all these rebels who are trying to overthrow the system and all of this other stuff. And he does it. He gets all this money, and he's just like, hey, wow, that's great. And then he realizes, that may have been kind of unfair to her. And then he's horrified when he realizes his guess was actually right. And he has to figure out what he's going to do about that. So anyways, that's The Water Thief. I also wrote Confessions of a Sin Eater. That is the biography of Confessions of a Sin Eater, Practicing Therapy in Hell on Earth. That was a biography I wrote with a former prison psychologist. He was 10 years giving therapy to the worst human beings you can imagine. Some of them you've heard of. These are people that have been in the news. And it was his job to give them therapy for 10 years. This is about the effect that it had on him, their stories, so on and so forth. So that is Confessions of a Sin Eater. After that, I did do the Humanist Codex. I actually did debates. I'd like to get back into that, but I did a lot of anti-theist and theist debates. You can find those on my channel. I even debated Ken Tobin, but then again, who hasn't?
Poor soul. I'm so sorry.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, because here was the other thing was he decided he'd only do it if it was on his channel with his moderator, and I agreed to all of those conditions. And everybody thought, oh my God, you're going to get hosed. But if you read all of the comments, most of them were saying, wow, he's, and I did this right after Aaron Raw, and they're like, you know, Aaron Raw is such a bully. This guy I get, this guy I listen to. And I was like, okay, he had, I think, 300,000 subs at the time. And I was talking to them, and I knew he wasn't, he doesn't even believe what he says he believes. I wasn't trying to talk to him. I was talking to the people watching the show who've never seen an atheist treat anybody, especially him, with dignity. And I hated calling him doctor, by the way, and as someone who has a number of members of his family and friends who are doctors, but I did it because I knew that was what was going to be needed to treat him with dignity and respect. I never outright contradicted him. But I'm proud of that debate. I think it was a good debate. It was a couple.
I'm gonna have to listen to that. I'm gonna have to go listen to that, because that would be fascinating. Because usually I'm used to Kep being a butthead. So
well,
you know,
I was.
Did you get him not to behave like a butthead?
Say that both of them were treating each other with dignity. Yeah.
Well, and so here's an example of ruthlessness and compassion.
Okay.
I did an intro for it, and I showed a whole bunch of whale hip bones. And later on, I talked about the ball and socket joint in evolution. And what he said was, no, 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 that's for the whale penis. And he likes to talk about whale penises a lot and all this other stuff. He says, if you had actually studied, you know that. And so I said, well, hey, listen, did you see the whale bones in the intro? He said, yeah. I said, I showed six of them. I also showed the museum numbers on all of them so you can look them up. Every single one of them was female. And I said, so all the ball and socket joints that you're referring to are on female whales. I said, well, I still don't know. I don't think maybe there was a mix-up at the museum. I said, okay. I live near the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. This is an email. I held up an email from a guy there, said, inviting the two of us to a whale necropsy on a female whale in 2 months. So you are hereby invited, and he will pull a female hip bone or female ball and socket joint out of a whale, and you can be there live when this happens. Oh, well, I need to check my schedule. I don't know that I could really do that. Massachusetts is a long ways away. I was worried that it was going to be too far for you. So this is the closest Oceanographic Institute to you. It's 2 hours from where you live. Here is an email from them also agreeing to do a whale necropsy with both you and I present. You don't have, I will pay for the flight. I will go down there myself. Let's get this sorted out. That is both ruthless and compassionate. I had seen every, I knew what his arguments were going to be beforehand. And I never once said the obvious, which is he's just trying to get out of it. But after I had every single, the three times out of it, people watching have to sit there and say, even if they're supporters of his, like, why is he refusing to do this? I'm not going to convert them there, but I'll sow the seeds of doubt. So I used to do a lot of that. Haven't done that in a while. I think his phone number's still on my phone, actually. I should probably do that. Okay, here's a question. Do I have to have my phone? Do I have to get like an exorcism on my phone if his number is still on there? We'll have to get an expert to answer that one. But
yeah, you might need another expert. I have only done one exorcism in my life, and it was fake. So
you may have to get like Ra or like someone that is like, you know, looks kind of, you know, weird to kind of do it. Cause then it'll look authentic. Just ask Arnold. Arnold, will you do an exorcism on my phone to get Ken Hoven off my phone?
Seems like a good idea. Yeah.
And then lastly, so I do believe that education is the silver bullet. I don't think there's any problems we cannot solve without education. So that's why I engage people. That's why I talk to people. I decided to start an educational program. It's called In Time. It does two really kinds of content. So there's two channels. It is a news and educational program. We talk about the news. We try to put it in context. We also try to find out what mainstream media is getting wrong and correct it. One of the big ones that, I mean, we did, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse, where the number of people who didn't understand what actually happened there, and we're like, look, you can say he's guilty or not, but the New York Times was the only ones who, for the most part, got it right, and almost everybody else would come out and say things that just were not true. And then when the not guilty verdict came out, I was like, well, I wasn't surprised, because I wasn't paying attention to what the news was saying. I watched the entire thing. So we cover stuff like that. We do breaking news. We oftentimes beat mainstream media. So I think if you go to that channel, you'll see, for example, we have been covering the Wagner insurrection, if you want to call it that, the coup. We've been covering it for 6 hours before ABC broke the story, and for about 3 or 4 hours before Reuters even had it in print. We have been covering it. This is because we scour social media. Usually they'll find it first on social media. We do our best to verify it, and then we go with it. So we're just watching the tanks rolling down. We're saying, okay, this is where it is. We're covering the whole map. So we've broken a number of stories, and we cover all the big stuff. We used to do a lot of interviews. We've done deconversion stories with Matt Dillahunty, Aaron Raw, Seth Andrews. We had Seth Andrews on, in fact, to talk about how to make the discussion better, because I think Seth Andrews really would agree with a lot of, I suspect would agree, don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think he'd agree with a lot of what we're talking about. We get mistaken for an atheist channel. We are a secular channel. I felt, only to be fair, we've actually had on conversion stories. So Dr. Cy Gart, who actually worked for the NIH and was a scientist and decided when he looked at the end of his microscope, he saw God. Uncontested. He was allowed to just talk about how and why. We weren't there to tell him he was right or wrong. We're there to hear his story. So we do shows on philosophy. We do shows on ethics. We cover current news. We have been covering Ukraine a lot. We're still not a Ukraine channel. We had on recently Lieutenant General Benjamin Hodges. He was the number two guy at NATO. He was the supreme commander of all NATO ground forces worldwide. He was also the commander of all U.S. forces in Europe. He was the second highest rank in the U.S. when he was in the military. So we've had him on once before. We have him booked twice coming up next month. We talk about NATO. We talk about world politics. Now we talk about Ukraine. We have a Ukrainian National Guardsman. Operator Starsky comes on every Friday to talk with us about Ukraine, and Commander Lance McMillan, who staged the Iraq War for the 5th Fleet out of CENTCOM. We have him on to talk about logistics, military issues, and lots of other experts. I love doing it. I love educating people and discussing these kinds of things. As you can tell, I love to talk too. So having my own show, it's great. Everybody wins. So that's in time. I hope you guys will check us out.
You're a healthy narcissist, Nick.
Well,
there is healthy narcissism. It's a thing. So I'm complimenting.
No, I'm aware. I'm sure most of the people who know me would agree with the first half or the second half of the statement. The narcissist part, you nail head, no problem. I think so we've got a Discord. And we are always constantly staying up with we have a channel just for LGBTQ rights. What's going on with that? The U.S. Supreme Court. What's going on in Ukraine? What's going on with Trump? And we have separate threads on our Discord. And it's an educational program. If you want to see what's going on and what other people are thinking about this, go on. And we're also kind of a community channel. The shows are often dictated by collaboration of people who sit down and say, this is what we need to talk about to make sure that people are as informed consumers of media as they can be. So that's In Time.
Awesome. And I have shared that link in the chat and we'll put it in the show notes as well. And that is great. We love educational channels here. So thank you for sharing that and for sharing all of your thoughts and insights this evening. This has been a really great conversation. I loved it a lot. And Helen knows I'm always excited to add to my book list. And I have added to my book list on Goodreads tonight.
I don't have a book list because I always say I'm going to read and I don't.
Well, that's the same Audible thing I do. That's what Audible, a book list is.
I do Audible. I do. But I am my ADHD and my life, like I like things in short bits.
Yeah. That's what I love about audiobooks. Yeah. No, it's great.
Or I just make friends with smart people and then I just have conversations with them and be like, I know the smart person.
Right. You got the points.
I got points now.
Love it. But I am reading The Water Thief next. That is on.
Oh,
I
feel
like
marvelous.
The way I'm looking at it is that if you around smart people, you become smart by osmosis.
Yeah, osmosis.
You know, osmosis. Osmosis. Well, not osmosis. Osmosis.
That's what Neil deGrasse Tyson says. Always hang out with smarter people. I don't know how the fuck he manages that, but that's
right.
It's well, easy God, for me.
Well, the thing is, though, is that he's very smart about astrophysics and an educator, but he doesn't know everything. So, you know, if he hangs around with, like, you know, a neurosurgeon, he's not a neurosurgeon. So he, you know, so they look at it that way because you can't know everything. Though it feels like Neil deGrasse Tyson
you can
knows
try
everything.
You can try.
May I quickly?
Yes.
So you dropped a link to the website, which is awesome. It's not as maintained as well as it should be, but the show is youtube.com/intimeshow.
Oh,
so
hold on. Let me grab that. youtube.com/intimeshow. Is that what you said? Yeah. Ah, there
it
is. Okay. I'm going to drop that as well. Thank you for giving us that. And we'll add that to the notes too. And we have pretty much used up all of our time. I think we answered just about all of the questions that we had. Actually, someone did ask a definition question. So I am going to let us end with that. If you can answer it in 3 minutes or less. How do you define religion?
Oh, Jesus.
3 minutes or less.
3 minutes or less. Thanks.
Pop quiz.
Thank you for that. Okay. Most words have multiple definitions, and no one word has the same definition in two minds. None. Words are actually metaphors. They represent a thing. So if I say table, everybody in here just got an image of a completely different object. It's going to have some similarities, but words are actually categories for things. What fits into the category of religion depends on who you talk to and what their motivation and agenda is. People who are anti-theists tend to think of religion as anything that is a superstitious belief. So you're actually practicing religion if you think the reason you win sports games is because you're wearing your lucky blue sock. That's religion. I don't view that as religion. I don't think that's religion. In my view, in order for that word to have meaning that is differentiated from words like faith or superstition, because those words do exist and we don't want everything to be the same word, it has to have a meaning that's outside of that. For me, religion is an organized set of practices based around specific beliefs that are faith-based beliefs as opposed to knowledge as opposed to beliefs based on evidence, reasoned evidence. There you go. That's what I'm going to use.
Wow. That was one minute and that was great. Excellent. And on that note, let's wrap up before we get more really good questions.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, Healing, and Support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.